my name's Paul Greatrix, and it's a great pleasure to introduce this latest episode of My Imaginary University, featuring Heidi Fraser-Krause, who's Chief Executive Officer of JISC. Heidi creates a distinctive northern university, which has been built by the people, for the people. Whilst traditional red brick in some ways, it has a strong research portfolio, as well as a substantial adult education programme, and is a very open campus. The university town itself also benefits significantly from the vibrant multiculturalism and international makeup of the institution. It's not just the campus which is open though. The curriculum is extremely flexible and follows something akin to the Scottish general degree model. Heidi is a very visible and down-to-earth vice-chancellor too, a reluctant one perhaps, but with no airs and graces and very closely involved with the student union. Distinctively, this university has a strong focus on efficiency, with the aim of removing unnecessary complexity from its operations in order to deliver savings for investment in education and research. No platforming is banned and constructive debate is encouraged, as are student clubs and societies of all kinds, but especially for mountaineering, Heidi's favourite, and they're rightly seen as key aspects of student life and belonging. Finally, we learn that the university anthem is a powerfully directive tune, which provides essential advice for students studying in the north. Right, well, welcome everyone to the latest episode of My Imaginary University. And this time it's my enormous pleasure to welcome Heidi Fraser-Krause, who is Chief Executive Officer of JISC, the famous and prominent sector agency. Heidi, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, I'm really excited to hear what imaginary HE institution you've come up with. Just to be clear to listeners, Heidi shared nothing with me about her ideas in advance, so I've got no idea what she's going to come up with. But let's hear the vision, let's hear the big picture, and start off with the outline of what kind of imaginary institution you've created then, Heidi.
So my imaginary institution is in the north. I haven't given it a location, and the reason I've said that is because I reflected on myself, who I am, and I am a northerner. You know, I am somebody that hails from, well, the northwest originally, but I feel most comfortable in the north of England, in the north. And it's red brick, my university.
Right.
Particularly keen, and I've worked at a number of universities, but I'm really, really keen on those universities who were established by the people for the people. So the Sheffield model is one of the ones, you know, it was the penny.
Yeah.
Red, blue penny, or I can't remember the exact term, but there was this idea that the town came together and said, we need an institution of learning. This is to support our people. So that's what I'm really interested in, that sort of civic movement around educating our people with, it's not from on high, it's a local thing. So that's where I go on that one.
Right. And is it so it's a kind of Victorian origin, or is it more recent people's movement?
It could be more recent. It doesn't have to be Victorian. It's more so, I mean, York's another example where York itself petitioned to get a university for itself. You know, it was people who thought this town should have a university. So, no, it doesn't need to be Victorian. Its buildings don't need to be Victorian. Having the odd nice one of those is always good. That's what people think of the university, you know, one of those ones with, you know, either red brick, lovely old fashioned Victorian tiles and whatever. So a bit of that, like a bit of that, but also very keen on that modern, you know, some amazing good learning spaces and research spaces that are modern. So a combination.
A combination of old and new. And of course, it's easy enough to, even if you've not started off with those Victorian buildings, you can always buy them and pretend that you owned them all along. But OK, so it's in a big town up north. And it's a university that isn't of the people. So Is it, what other distinctive features that, because you could argue that those 19th century civic universities, some of them have diverted from those roots in terms of their civic connections and gone a different way. So what is it about this university that keeps it close to the people then?
So the things that I've seen work really well, and what I like about my imaginary university, is where people come in, you know, so they often will have festivals, events, open areas, yeah. You know, where people yeah. are invited in. And I think the civic movement and this sort of red brick ideas, I'm afraid I'm not being very original here. You know, being with my imaginary university isn't terribly original. So maybe we'll come on to some other bits later. But it's that idea that learning is for everybody. And I should also say, this university will do research. I've worked at a number of universities, and that research piece where there are people beavering away on these important problems for the world is really energizing and I think very beneficial for the town, for the students who are at the university, and for UK PLC actually. So the bit around having those outreach, lots of universities will do these work where they'll have their students going supporting school children, there'll be festivals, there'll be sports clubs that use university centre, there'll be drama, that whole bit of, and also adult education is something that again is, it opens up the university to its local populace, and I found that a very good model, breaking down those town and gown pieces.
Okay, that's a really interesting point about adult education, because it's something that was effectively kind of killed off in the 90s with the change in funding model, which took all the money away from those non-accredited, you know, traditional outreach, continuing education, adult education courses. So this university is going to do that nevertheless.
Yes. Because and lots of universities have still continued to do that, actually, despite the funding piece. And I feel that's really important. It's how I engaged with a university before I was a university student, if you know what I mean. You know, yeah, my local university, which was Lancaster, did these sorts of things. And my mum, you know, participated in courses. So, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, allows you to get inside the doors. And sports facilities is the other thing that universities often make available to people. I feel that's really important.
I think this is really interesting, because it is a bit different, and actually having a mission to engage in that way is really important. So what other aspect, I get the outreach stuff, going to schools, etc. Having a university which has open doors can be quite hard in a town, because, you know, obviously there are, you know, you've got lots of students, but you've also got facilities, you've got valuable assets. So how do you manage that kind of public openness then, with the need to, you know, to look after the facilities that you're providing for students, and indeed that research activity?
Well, there's a real tension there, isn't there? Because you know, you go to every building and you need a swipe card to get into it. Which is what you'll have in lots of buildings. So I suppose the way you have to manage that is, when you do have things that are open, events or whatever, that's really well signposted and well done. You come here. You know, the bureaucracy around gaining access is as low as possible. But you're quite right. You know, you can't just have million-pound equipment sitting in labs and people able, or just, you know, computers in rooms that people could whip. So there is a tension there. But again, I've seen people do it well. You know, welcome into our spaces. And I think lots of people will accept. You know, you can go so far in a building, but there'll be areas that are out of bounds.
Yeah. So it's managed openness, but, you know, with the principle. Right. OK. So we'll come on to research in a bit, but let's go back then to the kind of the prospectus. What is it in terms of the range of courses on offer? Is it completely comprehensive, or is it slightly more niche, or are there the particular areas of strength and novelty that you've got on offer?
Well, I think this is a really difficult one, isn't it? Because if you look at the civics, they tend to do it all. You know, they've got architecture and medicine and veterinary studies and dentistry and philosophy and whatever. Now, again, I'm a fan of that. I think the thing that I really want my university to do is to be very, very keen on that ability to work in or to study and do research in an interdisciplinary way. So when I went, so the Scottish model is the one. So I studied in Glasgow, and when I joined the faculty, I joined in Glasgow, which was a social sciences faculty. I didn't just sign up for a degree. I signed up for faculty entry, and I then had a lot of choice about what I could do in my first and second year. So it was a 4-year degree in my first and second year. So I did philosophy and German as part of my, so I did a joint honours later on in psychology and management studies, but I was able to do philosophy and German. And that was hugely beneficial to me. So I'd never studied philosophy. I didn't know anything. And this was a sort of, you know, 101 philosophy, you know, the sort of thing to do. I learned massive amounts from that. And that was really beneficial. And I also had the ability to change the degree. I thought I'd come in to do a degree in psychology and management studies, but I could have changed that. I could have gone down to single honours. I could have taken something else. That flexibility to do different combinations of things, and I think the Scottish system does that well. When I moved to England, to York, because I was at St Andrews before that, I was shocked that you came in and into the English department, and then the only thing you could do was English, you know, and joint degrees were really difficult to do and manage. And I think I'm really interested in that ability to, so it's a bit like that American liberal arts college model, isn't it? But this idea that you don't actually know what you want to do when you come into university, or you think you do, but the ability to try different things out is really key for me.
Okay, so it is comprehensive, but actually there's a huge amount of flexibility for students to move around, to put together programmes themselves within a structure which one assumes that the sophisticated timetabling...
The trouble with this, and I know this from very, very hard won and painful experience, is how do you make the timetable work in that way? You know, and there are definitely, aren't there, well-honed paths through a timetable. So, you know, in St Andrews, there were a group of students who wanted to do physics and philosophy. And that was really hard to get the ability to do that. There were modules you could take. But yes, I absolutely agree. There is massive complexity in that. And we'll maybe come back to complexity later on. Yes, so that is my ideal.
Okay, excellent. Right. And in terms then of the student experience, I mean, are there other aspects of the student? Because living in a town where, you know, you are actually kind of part of the community as well, is a bit different, actually, as opposed to being, initially parceled off in a hall of residence and, you know, in a bit of a bubble. So is that part of the student experience too?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that being, I've done the range. I've done the campus experience, as in I've worked on a campus university, and I think that's lovely. The campus bit, you know, Lancaster's campus university, York's campus university, but you are in a bubble. If you're in a university that's much more integrated into your town, you know, there isn't the them and us piece as much. There is a bit, you know, this is a student area, not a student area. But I think that there is more of that. You're part of the city, as opposed to you go to this little bubble and study and whatever, and then you go off back home and then you come in. So no, I feel that's what my university would do. So there's lots of them that with that model, isn't there?
Okay, excellent. Excellent. And in terms of you mentioned research earlier. Again, it's a broad-based university. So are there things about the research programme that are, you know, particularly connected to the local area, or are there other specialisms that you've imagined?
So no, I haven't. That's not what I would aim for. I mean, those things often develop, don't they? So you might be, if you've been in a town that's been very good at ceramics, for example, you might have people who've come out of that and have got expertise. But I think it's more those world problems I'm interested in this research addressing, obviously with a relevance to the UK, but also, you know, And I think the thing about research is that it joins, it is an international community, and we can't get away from that bit. You know, you look at any of the major discoveries, there will have been competing groups and collaborating groups from across the world. And, you know, that's how you solve those big problems. You bring great minds together from different places. So no, I don't see it as being necessarily focused on the research issues of the local area, but that may well happen.
So you've set a pretty clear vision for this kind of contemporary yet Victorian civic ideal. As Vice Chancellor at this institution, then, I mean, what kind of leader are you?
So can I just first make it extremely clear? I would never, ever want to be a vice chancellor.
It is imaginary, though. But, you know, so but you can choose not to be however,
in my desert island disc moment here, my imaginary university. So there's a few things I wouldn't have, for example. Right. So I wouldn't live in the house.
Right.
I wouldn't have the chauffeur driven car. You know, I would be much more a vice chancellor of the people. I would see myself as being the leader of the institution. I mean, I know that sounds like a daft thing to say, but the leader of the institution. But also, my key bit as a leader is to build a team of people around me who have got, you know, lots of those great ideas, and for me to enable that to happen. So that's how my leadership model would be, as somebody who helps with defining strategic direction, well, you know, has a big influence on strategic direction, etc., but he's there to support other people in the institution who are making that happen. Somebody who was visible, you know, so I would see myself as a vice chancellor who would be around. People would know who I was. I would try and participate in things, university things, and I don't just mean the sort of formal ceremonial things like that. I mean, you know, going along to different things, participating in relevant things for a vice chancellor. You know, there's all sorts of things vice chancellors can do to support the institution. So trying to be not a lofty figurehead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's very much in keeping with the ethos of the institution. I think you've described. So I'm just thinking of how that plays out in relation to, for example, the Students' Union then, because, I mean, you could imagine that it's the kind of thing where you would actually be quite close to a Students' Union executive, or you would see it as your role to engage them closely in what's going on in the university.
No, absolutely. I mean, and I think that if you get that relationship to work well, it is of benefit to everybody at the university, students and staff alike. So, yes, Vice Chancellor listening to what students are looking for. And I think there's lots of tiptoeing through some of this. There are some, I think the difficulty I've observed and been in the middle of with student unions is that you get a different set of people in as your sabbatical officers, usually every year, sometimes every 2 years. And some of those things what they set out of their manifestos are not achievable in a year. And somebody else comes along and has a totally different set of ideas. So I think that the challenge there is to try and build a really good relationship with the union and almost sometimes hold a mirror back up and say, well, hang on a second, you know, the consequences of what you've suggested here would be this. I don't think this is actually a good idea, or you're absolutely right, but it's going to take longer than your time in office to achieve this.
Yeah.
And I think having that mature relationship is hard too, because if you're a student activist, you're campaigning on a platform, there's certain things you want to do. How do you move that one forward?
Yeah, but they're also part of that community as well, aren't they? Yeah. So, you know, so they've also got, you know, I assume they will see themselves as having responsibilities in the town as well as, you know, that engagement with their own membership.
That's why I say, if you can get that relationship to work well, it is of benefit to everybody. You know, so if you've got that, you know, it is not acceptable for us to drop litter and make lots of noise and whatever, you know, as part of the ethos of the student body, supported by the union, you know, it's a win-win, isn't it, for everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Coming back then to the kind of profile of the institution, because, you know, there is a sense in which, you know, we focused very much on the local and not really talked about the national and international. And yet, in order to succeed in the way that you've described, you will have to be, you know, have that national and international profile and recognition. So how does that manifest itself? I mean, what is the view of the university in terms of the, you know, the national and international profile?
Well, I think both are important. You know, so I think that you can find universities who focus solely on their international profile or solely on their national profile. But I think if you are, as I've described, doing research, you will have an international profile. If you're doing world-leading research, you'll have an international profile. I was always struck. I went to a session in the early 2000s at the University of Edinburgh, which was led by the Vice Chancellor, and he talked about the university being truly international. Now, this was a session for professional services staff, and he talked about the benefit of having international staff, professional staff, academic staff, and students as part of that community. And that always struck me as something that it'd be really good to get. So to think of international in the broadest sense of the word, because it's often thought of international students, international profile for research, but actually think of yourselves totally as international from every lens, because you will learn different things. So I think that's what I would be looking at. You know, how can we? And again, one of the things I really loved about working at universities was, you know, that often there would be this statistic, we have got 150 nations represented. You know, how often, you know, do you meet people from Outer Mongolia, Bali, or whatever it is, you know, in normal life? And so I think that international piece is vital. Say, science research generally, I shouldn't focus just on science, but research generally is an international endeavour. And I feel education is an international endeavour as well. So very open. See, that is very important.
Yeah,
there's also a tension about the town.
Yeah. But well, I mean, there is, but also, I mean, the town is likely to, I mean, it won't be an entirely isolated bubble in itself either, will it? Because actually, it may well be a multicultural place in any case, and very, very diverse in and of itself. So actually, the university will simply be amplifying that diversity, and it creates a richer and more, you know, culturally vibrant life for everyone living in it. Yes, there can be tensions, but there can be enormous benefits as well.
I couldn't have put it better myself.
Well, you're drawing me into your vision here, and I'm I'm very much on board with the creation of this institution. So let's see, are there any other features of the institution that we've not mentioned yet? I mean, you touched on the issue of complexity earlier, which we didn't really explore. So, but are there any other things you want to mention?
Okay, so there's two things I just wanted to pick up. So one of the things I would like to be distinctive about my university is that it will be very efficient and effective. Ah. So you would expect me to say that, coming from a background in technology, or we're in a role with technology. So I see universities as quite inefficient in the way that they run themselves at many levels. And part of that is complexity, actually. Part of it is complexity that we accept it has to be like that. We've got to be really complicated. So something like I just described, with this ability to do different modules from different programs or whatever, is one of those. But I think we also, I think that's a good thing. So I could justify that complexity, but I think there is lots of complexity which is nonsense and adds no value, in fact takes away value. So I am very interested in trying to find which bits of complexity add value and which are simply a millstone around our necks, and using technology in its broader sense, so looking at process and technology, to make us much more efficient. Because there, you know, this is a common theme, isn't it? That, oh, so much bloody bureaucracy, another form to fill in. whatever. We need to think about ourselves in a different way. We need to challenge some of the ways that we were and take some of the leaf out of industries that have transformed themselves with technology, keeping the good bits of what we do, you know, but sort of sorting out all of that dross, all of those things that are just because we've always done it that way, or we've never dared challenge it. So that'd be one of the things I'd be distinctive about.
Like, that, I mean, you know, and that would be it's a bit of a holy grail for universities, that, isn't it? You're right. I mean, it often bumps up against everything that we want to do in terms of that opening up a curriculum, but also enabling, you know, academic staff in particular to plow their own furrow, do what they want in terms of research or other activity. But the benefit of it is, you know, an efficient and effective university actually enables money to be dedicated more to improving education, student experience and research, because you aren't spending your whole time filling in forms or trying to do 20 different things. You know, 20 different one thing 20 different ways. So I think you're absolutely right. But I do like it doesn't it's an interesting combination with the traditional civic, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there aren't many of them that I could describe that are like that. Sorry, and the second point I was just going to come back to was just to return to that students bit. I learned an enormous amount when I was at university by the student clubs and societies I was involved in. So I was in the mountaineering club in Glasgow and I had a fabulous time. I mean, I also tried out other things. I did scuba diving for a bit and I did played hockey and I was in the choir. So I tried out a number of things. But I ended up, my North Star was mountaineering. And so the student experience piece of that, being able to participate, whether it's theatre, whether it's hockey, football, drama, you name it, I think that bit and that relationship, therefore, between the SU and the university for making sure that there's, you know, support for those facilities and clubs, was a real defining part of my student experience, I have to say. And I would hope, I mean, I recently looked at the website of Glasgow University Mountaineering Club. And you know what? It warmed the cockles of my heart, because all the things that they were talking about, the ethos was still there, you know, 30 odd. Oh my God, how long ago did I? Quite a while ago. But you know, 30 years on, there was still that fun around going into the hills and doing interesting things and a bit of anarchy around it and whatever. It was great. And so I hope that still exists. I haven't been in a student society for a very long time, but I hope that still exists. So I'd be very keen to make sure that that's part of the student experience and that relationship with the SU.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it's one of those things that makes the university special for students. But the other element of it is it's about binding students in as well, right? It's about developing that sense of being a part of something, that sense of belonging, which is hugely important for enabling students to make the most of their opportunities whilst they're at university, but also making it much less likely that they become disengaged and disaffected. And yeah, being in the mountaineering club or the rowing club, whatever it might be, can absolutely be a central part of that.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, if I reflect, the friends I made from university, which I'm still in touch with a number of them, were not from my course. They were from, you know, the clubs and societies, and I met people studying all sorts of different disciplines in the mountaineering club. So I think it's another way, isn't it, of broadening out experience. Yeah, so there were medics and there were philosophers and there were mathematicians and whatever else. Really, really key.
And fortunately, the university is, as you mentioned, up north, so there's plenty of mountains for people to go.
Mountains, though, might it? Because that's the other thing. Go and look at, you know, what's on offer at your university, because it may well be, you know, what was it? There were a few of them that I thought, slackline walking club, and there, you know, there are all sorts of these things that are, you know, it was great.
Okay, so we'll go back. You are the vice chancellor here, right? So, and whilst you are a vice chancellor of the people, you nevertheless have you know, significant powers, right? So you do have the power to ban stuff, right? Is there anything that you are not allowing in your university?
So, I mean, this, if we're on the topic here of the sort of no platforming debate, I am against the idea of no platforming. I think what I would want to encourage, so I think I would ban no platforming. That's the right thing. But what I would want is, again, from my experience, I went to a number of debates when I was at university on contentious topics, and they always had both sides. So you couldn't, you might have somebody with a particularly strong view on, I'll take something imaginary, cheese making, right? Somebody thought cheese making should be done this way, and somebody else had a totally different view on how that should be done. And there was then one side put their arguments and the other side knocked them down. And then they had a debate. So I think that the way you learn about lots of these things is you don't, if you have somebody who has a particular contentious viewpoint, you need to know what the other point of view is. You need to have those contentious views challenged. And I think that that's how you learn to make up your own mind. I think the echo chamber of, we're going to invite so-and-so who's particularly interested in a particular point of view and thinks they're right, and then we ban them because we don't like what we're going to say is the wrong thing. You need to listen to both sides of the argument. And I know this is really difficult, been involved in these sorts of things, really hard work. But I think that's what I would be wanting to support.
Okay. Well, I mean, fortunately, you are able to create an environment in your imaginary university where these things can happen, and all those really difficult things that currently trouble us, you know, you can actually keep them away. So you can have that kind of constructive and managed and reasonable and rational debate, which we all really, really, really want. Right. A final thing then, Heidi, if I may, which is music, right? Every university needs music. So what's your anthem?
Right. OK, so my university anthem is the Baz Luhrmann song Class of 99. Right. And the reason I say that is because I only heard that song maybe 15 years ago, I don't know. And the first line of that song is enjoy the power and beauty of your youth, right? And then it says, never mind, you know, you'll not appreciate the power and beauty of your youth until they're over. And I think the song is just full of things that when you're older, you listen to that song, you think, oh God, you know, there's a line that says, you are not as fat as you imagine. You know, there's all these things. Don't mess with your hair. Look after your knees. You know, there's these sorts of things. So I think as a fun university anthem, that will be one of them. Not the Gaudiamus. So no Latin. That will be the other thing I should say. No. About university. No Latin.
So that you have banned something.
Latin.
And of course that song will be obviously perfect for graduation as well. Heidi, we need to stop there, but listen, thank you so much for sharing your ideas of a wonderful imaginary university up north, and it's been great talking to you and learning about it, but thank you so very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
I do hope you enjoyed this edition of My Imaginary University. There should be more episodes along soon. In the meantime, you might like to listen to the equally higher education focused podcast, University Registrars Talking About Stuff, in which I talk to senior university leaders, most of them registrars or equivalent, about their careers and various bits of HE stuff. Just Google it to find many interesting episodes to listen to.